Well, good afternoon. We're going to continue in our series in Exodus. This is the crescendo of the chapters that we've been reading. It's the last one in the series before Christmas as we head into Advent. And we're going to be thinking this morning about a God who delivers and what that means for the people of Israel in their time, but what it means for us today. I'm going to be thinking about three key areas. The first one is direction. The second one is disappointment, and the last one is deliverance. Direction, disappointment, and deliverance. Firstly, we want to think about direction before we head to the passage. And in our lives, we can think about many different choices that we have every day, like what cereal am I going to have in the morning, or am I going to have toast? What shoes am I going to wear? We can think about school and what subjects we're going to study, or what exams we're going to do, or are we going to go to college or university? Are we going to do a gap year? Are we going to be in a relationship? Are we one day going to get married? If we get married, will we maybe have kids? If we maybe have kids, how will they get on? We think about, am I going to get a job? Am I going to keep my job? I'm going to stay in my job. I'm going to get another job. Is this job going to be okay? Am I going to one day have grandchildren? If my grandchildren, how are they going to be? Are they going to grow up? Are they going to have kids? Are they going to have a job? And all these kind of questions that go around our head that fill our minds about direction. And in these moments, which are true for all of us, we have a choice. We can either worry about these questions of direction, or we can choose to worship. We either worry about these questions, or we can choose to worship, because essentially, as disciples of Jesus Christ, we've been made as worshippers. But so often we worry, if we're honest, about such questions. Such things occupy our time and our thinking. If we went round the room and we were all honest about that, that would be the case for all of us, that we a lot of our time is consumed by thinking about the what ifs. And if I had this in my life, then my life would be fulfilled with purpose. And we fill in the blanks. But it's the same for those people in Israel, the Israelites, in the time of Egypt. And what we see is a very clear pattern of direction. So when we turn back to chapter 13, and we'll just read a few verses from that, we see this clear indicator of direction being true for them. Exodus 13, 17, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road towards the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt ready for battle. So they themselves were saying, well, hold on a minute. This isn't the most direct route. I mean, we want to go from A to B. We're trying to get away from the Egyptians. We want to go from here to here, but you're taking us round a kind of strange route. And so as we can see on this map, if we remember back in the early time of looking at Exodus, they came to this fertile land of Goshen, and then he brings them down this route through Succoth, and they go the way through the way of the wilderness, and then they come down to Pi Hahiroth, and then eventually go to Baal Zephon. And so they're looking at this and they're saying, well, this doesn't make sense. Like, I mean, the obvious route is not the obvious route that God has taken us on. I mean, he's directing us like the long way round here, and you are God. And so what's going on here? And so it can be like that for us in our life. You see, that we can think that somehow we're being taken this way or that way, or we feel like we're going around roundabouts in life and we're saying, God, what are you saying to me? I mean, the most obvious thing for me would be to go from here to here because I can see where I need to go. But God's saying, well, I'm not taking you that way. I'm taking you that way, and you're going that way, and then you're coming off at that junction, and then we're going back up there because you're going to see a different route when I take you that way. And by the way, I'm the one that leads you. That's the profound thing that we see right away. God leads his people. Notice that in verse 18. So God led the people. God led the people. We stupidly think that we can maybe lead God, but God leads the people, and he leads the people in a direction that they thought, well, hold on a minute, this isn't the way we thought we would go. And that's like your life and my life, that we seem to somehow go in different directions that we didn't necessarily think was the direction that we thought we were going to go. But God takes us in different routes to show us that he's God and what he has for us. And so this direction and this leading is made even clearer when we look at Exodus 13:20. After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. So the presence of God, we are led by God and his presence. So the cloud goes in front of his people, the fire goes in front of his people, and they follow the presence of God. Can we let that one sink in just a moment? It's like a Sunday school kind of explanation, but it's so often we're not living as if that was true. You see, if God was leading us, we would follow his lead. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and then these things will be added to you. And so we are to follow his presence. He is the one who leads his people. We don't lead him, he leads us. We follow his lead. And that's a very foundational, basic truth that we quickly forget in the heat of the moment and the heat of the day. He leads his people. He leads you. He leads me if we trust in him. And then when we fast forward to Exodus 14, we're not going to cover every verse. We don't have the time to do that. But we're going to pick up some key verses in Exodus 14. So let's go to Exodus 14:10. And it says, as Pharaoh approached the Israelites, looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? You see, the Pharaoh and the armies were coming up against them, and they were looking at the armies, and they were terrified. And let's be honest, if we were in that position, we'd probably be freaking out going, what is going on? There's an army coming over hill. The Egyptians, we were told we were getting out, and now Pharaoh's changed his mind, and he sent the armies, and he said he wants us back for slaves, and he's chasing after us. And they were terrified, and they cried out to the Lord. And so we like the idea, or at least maybe most of us, maybe we're not in that position where we're willing to go for God to lead us. But if we are a Christian, we like the idea that God leads us. But in the heat of the moment and in difficulties, is that true? So more often than not, if life is going very well and we're having nice holidays and we've got nice food on the table and our work's going well, and our school's going well, and our university or college is going well, or retirement's going well, we can go, yeah, great, God's leading me. Yeah, I get this. I'm supposed to follow his will, and I'm supposed to worship him. But when things are not going well, when work is not going well, when college or school is not going well, it can often lead to disappointment with God in our lives. Have you ever noticed that in your own life? I've seen moments of that in my life too. You see, when your health goes, or when your work is uncertain, or you didn't quite get what you thought you were going to get, it can lead to disappointment, which leads to bitterness in our hearts. And so rather than looking up and worshiping God, they began to look inwards, and they began to look backwards, and they began to say, well, hold on a minute, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us here to the desert to die? What have you done to us? And they began to blame Moses. And that's what happens, doesn't it, when we get disappointed. We say, well, this is ridiculous. This shouldn't be going on. There's someone I need to blame for these problems in my life. I need to grumble about something or someone. Because actually, you know, I need to be in control of my life. So I'm disappointed. It's not going my own way. I'm going to blame God. I'm going to blame others. But actually, do we stop and look up and worship God in the time of trial as well as the time of joy? And then we see in verse 12 It says, didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. And just think about that for a moment. It's just crazy. One, they never said that. They never said, oh, we said to you, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians. So it's not true. But secondly, it doesn't make sense. Because they were saying, well, we were once slaves, and we want to go back to being slaves again. And there's a recognition that many of us could probably relate to in that. You see, living by the flesh, just going with the flow, in some ways is somewhat familiar and easier. So we're just going to do what everyone else is kind of doing, or I go back to what I used to do because that's familiar. But this following God stuff and this submitting to his kingdom, well, it's a little bit hard sometimes. So I'll go back to what I know. I mean, we'd have been better off remaining slaves. But the gospel is not about being enslaved and going back to slavery. It's not about behavior change in our life. It's not about trying to improve our lives. It's actually about coming from being in slavery to freedom. It's about being dead and becoming alive. It's not about just being a little bit better. It's about a huge transformation that goes from death to life. And so effectively, they were saying, well, we want to go back to being dead again. We want to be slaves again. But we stupidly do that in our lives sometimes, often when disappointment comes, often when troubles come. Oh, well, I'm just going to take my foot off the gas a bit and just, you know, whatever, go back to the way that I used to live. It's what I know. It's familiar. But then we see in verses 13 and 14 the idea of deliverance and the reality of deliverance. In verse 13, Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You only need to be still. Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance." So this kind of goes against all kind of strategic ideas, because what you would mostly do in this situation was you would either run as quick as you could, or you would fight against the army that's coming towards you. So you would either run or you would fight. But God's way of working and God's kingdom has a different way of thinking. And it's about not being afraid, but standing firm and being still, because the Lord will fight for us. And that speaks to us of God's grace. You see, if we think that the gospel and the Christian life is about performance, then we must work very hard at improving and quantifying our lives. Many of you work in areas of education or medicine where the pressure is being put on you to prove yourself, to validate what you're doing, to track the outcomes of your work, to create more paperwork in what you're doing. And so much of this is not about being made of the image of God and about being delivered and set free and trusting one another and allowing God to lead us. It's about us verifying ourselves, and we see the overspill of that within society. We see the overspill of that in social media. So I'm encouraged to broadcast that my life is going really well. I will give you the highlights reel of my life, and I will show you that I had a fantastic cappuccino in a cafe on a Wednesday. I will show you that actually I'm having a really nice dessert somewhere, or I'm having a very nice holiday. And so you're encouraged to do that, and I'm encouraged to do that, and we're encouraged to broadcast our lives to one another to really prove that somehow we have a valid life. And so we'll be very joyous if you get 100 hearts likes on Instagram, but your life might be devastated if nobody likes that new dress that you bought, or nobody likes that new tie that I wore on about 3 occasions in the year. But this is ludicrous, can't we see? What has happened to us that we reduce being human to liking things on Facebook, to tapping a heart on Instagram, and finding our verification and validation by such things. And people will tell you that mental health issues are rising because of such things. But we do the same in the workplace. Am I fulfilled? Am I validated? Are you validated? Can you prove yourself? Can I prove myself? We must be constantly proving ourselves, because it doesn't speak of grace. It speaks of performance and works. And grace says that I am validated by Christ, that I'm forgiven, that I'm a child of God, that I've been set free, and I no longer need to return to slavery. Now, I'm going to say something controversial. Is being obsessed with social media a form of slavery, where we just want people's validation? I'm not saying that all social media is bad, but one thing God was teaching me in the sabbatical is that this is no good for my ego. This is no good for community. It creates jealousy and envy. It creates people comparing one of themselves to each other, one-upmanship. And so let me say to you in love, as one of your pastors, let's think carefully about how we communicate in the world of the internet as if we were talking to one another face-to-face. Because it's freeing to know that you are validated by Christ and by his grace, and that I don't need to prove myself on Facebook, and neither do you. Because we're forgiven by grace, and we already have our validation. Now, we need to think through what that looks like for us. But it seems to me that we're in a world that's full of distractions, and that much of the internet and social media wants to distract us from paying attention. So in other words, if you are standing in a post office queue, or you're at a self-service checkout or waiting for something, are you grabbing for your phone to check who's liked one of your posts? Or are you stopping and processing what's gone on before you, or even praying for other people? Can't we see how much our minds are filled with just information, information, information? How am I doing? How are you doing? Information, more information. And one of the things that God was teaching us in our sabbatical was that we need to be more attentive to what God is saying. So we need to be still. And we need to be okay with being still, because God is working when we're still, and we don't have to validate ourselves. That God is working and God is at work when we're still. Reading from one of the commentaries on Moses, Edmund refers to the discipline of delay. And he says in his excellent book, The Disciplines of Life, he writes, "We live in a restless, impatient day. We have little time for preparation and less for meditation or worship. We feel we must be active and energetic, humanly effective. We cannot understand why inactivity, weakness, weariness, and seeming uselessness should be our lot. It all appears to be foolish and futile without plan or purpose." He then makes this profound statement: "The delay that instructs and prepares us saves time, never loses it." Let me read that last bit again. The delay, the being still, that instructs and prepares us saves time, it never loses it. So we're worried about what people think, where we're going to be more effective. When we delay and we're attentive, we're in many ways more productive, because we're allowing God to be at work in us and through us. And then we think, just going through the passage a bit more, in verse 21, "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground, with a wall of water on their right and on their left." And so in this dramatic moment, we see that Moses stretches out his hand, and all that night, I never quite noticed that before, that he was doing this all night. Imagine how sore his arms were as he mediated for the people of God. And all that night, the Lord drove the sea back. It wasn't Moses who drew the sea back. It was God working through Moses as an instrument to draw back the sea. His arms was out and stretched out and drawing the sea back, and the waters were divided and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground. And on the back of what I've just been saying about attentiveness, Tim Keller helpfully says that you are not saved by the quality of your faith, you are saved by the object of your faith. You are not saved by the quality of your faith, you are saved by the object of your faith. And I think that some of us really need to hear this clearly this morning as something that's freeing for us. Maybe we grew up in a church or churches where the emphasis was on the quality of your faith. You need to have 10 out of 10 faith. You need to have performance-related faith. You need to work harder, pray harder, study more, go faster spiritually. But this is the radical thing about grace. It's the faith, the quality of your faith. You are saved by the object of your faith. So the object of your faith is Jesus. So we are saved by the object of our faith. When we look to Christ, that is where we're saved. We're not saved by the quality of our faith. We're saved by the object of our faith. And so when we look to Christ, that's where we're saved. And we can't add to the object of our faith. That's the freeing thing, where we don't go back to slavery, but we're freed from performance-related Christianity, where the object of our faith, Christ, came and died for us to set us free, that we might be free. And so the only thing that we're being asked to do, essentially, is look at the object of our faith and not other things to find validation. Look to Christ. It's not about the quality of your faith. It could be the size of a mustard seed. It's the object of your faith, who is Christ. And so in this situation, that's very important, because as they walked through the sea, which was about crossing over from slavery to life, depending on their personality types, they would have looked at that very differently. And maybe you're one or two of these different personality types. So if you're a kind of gung-ho, outdoor kind of person, you'd have been like, wow, this is incredible. Look at the size of those waves. And man, look at the whales. And this is incredible. Come on, guys, let's run through this divide. This is fantastic. You know, this divide was about 9 miles long. It would have taken at least 2.5 hours to walk, if not 3-4 hours, depending if you stopped from a picnic on the way. This was mushy, and put yourself into the narrative of this. This is squelchy under your feet. There was water spraying all over the place. The personality types that love throwing themselves off cliffs would have been, this is fantastic. Let me get a surfboard. But probably most of us would have been like, okay, well, this has been like 35 minutes and I'm still walking through here. And I don't know about you, but if you just look a little bit further ahead, it looks like the water's coming in a bit. I'm not sure. Are we going to get through this? I mean, we've done 1.5 miles. Are we going to get through this divide or not? Because that water looks like it's spraying a lot up ahead. And I think I just saw a fish plop out there as well. So I think we're going to, I'm not quite sure. We're going to make this. Now, So the gung-ho who's like, yeah, come on, get me through this. Oh, yeah, get me a surfboard. Okay, she has faith. But the guy who's like, well, I don't know, is the water coming in? He has faith because he's moving. So it's not about the quality of the faith. It's about whether they move from one side to the other. Can't we see how freeing that is? So you're looking even in church, you go, well, I wish I could be as spiritual as that person because they just seem to be flying. But actually, most of us are just like, oh, was that a fish that plopped out there? Is the water coming in? But we're still moving, and we're still moving in faith. And then we see, just as we move towards the close of the last couple of slides, 24, 25, during the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He jammed the wheels of the chariots so that they had difficulty driving, and the Egyptians said, let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. They recognized that this was Yahweh, and amongst the 140 different gods, they finally came to realize that this was Yahweh, the only God who was to be worshipped. They recognized that as the chariots were jammed and they weren't going to win, that this was Yahweh who was at work. And so verse 27 and 28, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak, the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen and the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. The deliverance was clear. It was total. It wasn't partial. God exercised his judgment against the hardness of their hearts and delivered his people, taking them from one side to the other. He allowed them to cross over. And in the final verse, in verse 31, and when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. And this great quote from Spurgeon that sums up much of what I've been saying. My faith rests not in what I am or shall be or feel or know, but in what Christ is, in what he has done, and what he is now doing for me. It's Christ who is the object of our faith. And so as we look at this last slide, we're to think about direction. We're to think about who's directing who. Is the Lord leading us? Is the Lord guiding us? Are we willing to follow him? We think about disappointment in our life. What do we do with that? Are we disappointed because we're not looking to Christ as the object of our faith, and that Christ is the one who is the deliverer? See, Moses was a mediator for the people and allowed them to cross the sea from one side to the other. But there's a greater mediator, and that mediator is Jesus. And Jesus is the one who stands in the gap and allows us to go from death to life, from slavery to being free. And there is no other mediator that will enable us to do that unless we look to Christ as the one who is the great mediator. And just as I close, the picture up there, the rather funny looking picture, is of Hudson Taylor, who went to China but adopted the clothes of people from China to reach those fellow people. And let me read this. Hudson Taylor knew the testing that tempers the steel of the soul. He was an invalid, home at the age of 29. After 6 years of intensive service in China, he settled with his little family in the east side of London. Outside interest lessened, friends began to forget him, and five long hidden years were spent in the dreary streets of a poor part of London where the Taylors were shut up to prayer and patience. As the years of obscurity progressed, and when the discipline was complete, there emerged the China Inland Mission. At first only a tiny route, but destined of God to fill the land of China with a gospel fruit. When we recall the name of Hudson Taylor, does anyone ever mention those 5 years of obscurity in a poor part of London? Not likely. We're more prone to emphasize the prominent things about him. But remember this, China was reached because a man was faithful behind the scenes, patiently waiting with his family, waiting for the Red Sea to open. That's a lesson for all of us. And until we learn it, we're going to stay stuck in the cul-de-sac. Are we in a cul-de-sac? What is going to free us from being stuck in that spiritual cul-de-sac? Well, the one who will free us is the great mediator. It's Jesus. Jesus is the one who sets us free, who leads us out of the cul-de-sac so we don't constantly be stuck, and we follow his lead. That's what a disciple is, a worshiper who follows Christ's lead. Will we do that today? Will we do that today? To follow Christ as our great mediator who paid the price for us that we might go free as he died on the cross as our great mediator. Will we do that today? I'm going to ask the band to come up and I'm going to pray, and then as I finish praying, they're going to lead us in the last song. Father God, we thank you for this opportunity to meet together. We thank you for this journey that we've been on through Exodus. We thank you that your ways are greater than our ways, and we thank you that you want to lead us and you want to be our great mediator. We thank you that it's all of your grace. We thank you that we can't add to this. And so would you help us to learn and remember these things, take them to heart. And if anyone here hasn't yet trusted in the mediator, I pray that by the power of the Holy Spirit, that today could be the day that you take the step into the great Red Sea and by simple faith trust in him. In Jesus' name.